There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Do you talk to yourself? Do you do it out loud? Have you ever wondered what it means and why it happens? Do you find that it can be a motivating force that helps you work through and rise above challenges? Or does it become something that pulls you into a panic and anxiety where a bad experience gets played in your head on repeat? Here to discuss this and more is Chasity O'Connell, mental health counselor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. We'll also be talking about how to use cognitive behavioral therapy to change negative thoughts and behaviors. Plus, imaginary friends. What happens when we keep them beyond childhood? Find out which famous writer still relies on imaginary friends into adulthood. Well, hello. Good afternoon. Welcome, Chasity.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Are you all Christmased out from last week?
Not even close. It was the perfect introduction into like kicking the festive season off in the right direction. So
it was excited. It was great. But you've got a lot to save for Monday. But this is a topic that came to me as I was, in fact, talking to myself and thinking, there's got to be something in this, because oftentimes I'll just kind of zone out and start talking internally to myself, and sometimes I'll catch myself talking out loud, and I've picked up the kids from school, and then I'll just be replaying things in my mind that happened that day, and I'll start talking them through and talking to myself, and they're like, oh, you know, Mum, stop talking to yourself, snap out of it kind of thing. But then I go to work and I talk to Joe, my producer. And I said, Joe, I talk to myself. Do you talk to yourself? And what did you say?
All the time.
All the time.
I often have a little conversation with myself. Where I used to live, my neighbour always took the mickey out of me because she'd say, I've just seen you walk all the way to my house having a full animated conversation with yourself. Sometimes a little argument with myself. I'll also do a little bit of mumbling every now and again. But yeah, no, I do quite happily.
And is it for you going through negative stuff that's happened that you just want to get out of your system? Or is it you kind of, motivating yourself for something that's going to happen later on and you're thinking about how to handle it? What is it for you?
I think potentially it's a grudge, usually. I'm nee. But I will talk to myself, or I'll do lists out loud. And if I'm kind of pottering around the house doing things, my husband will often giggle and go, having a nice conversation there. The great thing about having a conversation with yourself is that nobody answers back, Sally.
Well, exactly. Nobody answers back, and you can kind of say what you wanted to say in the first place. Sometimes you might not be able to say what you want to say in that situation, but you kind of get it out and you think, oh, I should have said that, or I should have done this, or I should have done that. But then again, that might not be so positive either. There are so many things to unpack here, Chasity. Where do we start? With this, what is it called, first of all? Is it inner speech? Is that what it's called?
Wow. Well, I love the topic and I'm really excited about it because for all the reasons that you and Joe have been talking about over the past few moments. The zoning out, or the talking to yourself, or the arguing or replaying things in your head. These are all components of just thinking. And I think what is incredible about it is if you think about the reality that we think. So there's not a moment when we're not thinking. And so it's interesting to see which thoughts that stick with us and which ones slide off. So is it the thought about the argument that you had with your friend or your spouse the day before? That's the one that sticks rather than other thoughts that we're having throughout the day. So there's a lot to unpack. And from a research perspective, you know, because of how complex this issue is, they spend a lot of time looking at the quality of the thoughts and the kind of thinking that we have. Is it that we're stuck on a thought and we can't get it out of our head? Is it something more of an intrusive thought? Is it something that we're just driving along and all of a sudden we have this horrible thought and we just don't know why or how we got there? Is it negative? Do we talk to ourselves in a way that is extremely harsh, or is it compassionate? Is it loving? Is it supportive? So there's so much to understand and identify. And I think the first part of the unpacking part that you mentioned is bringing it to our awareness that what is actually happening is a thought, and we do exercise a degree of control, maybe not necessarily over the thought sort of spontaneously occurring, but how we recognize them and ultimately respond to these thoughts.
How common is it for people to be kind of talking to themselves, whether it's internally, you know, you're doing it inside, but or out loud?
It is so common. It is so common. And it's the kind of thing, if you Google, you'll see results like people who talk to themselves are more successful than people that don't.
They're geniuses, actually, yes, according to some.
There you go. So we must all be super, super smart.
Because
I definitely talk to myself. I think so many people do. And part of it is, why are you doing it? And sometimes it's trying to make sense of things that are happening. Sometimes it's what are my next steps going forward? And sometimes it's self-reflection, and where it's much deeper. Is this how I want my life? You know, is this what I want to be known for? So it's understanding the patterns of the thoughts that we have and how they impact our behavior. So, you know, tying it to that cognitive behavioral piece, we have these thoughts, but what does it mean for us and what do we do about it?
It's interesting because they've been trying to study this in psychology, you know, for such a long time.
Absolutely.
More than a century, we've actually known that inner speech is accompanied by tiny muscular movements in the larynx. Mm. So even when you do it internally, actually your larynx is moving at the same time, mimicking that speech. And it's detectable in a technique that is called electromyography. In the 1990s, neuroscientists used functional neuroimaging to demonstrate that areas like the left inferior frontal gyrus or Broca's area, which are active when we speak out loud, are also active when we have that inner speech that is going. So there are all kinds of things going on in the brain.
Absolutely.
Even though we might not be vocalizing out loud.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You mentioned that Broca's area, and that's involved in speech production, whether it's voiced or whether it's in our head. And you can even look at how that impacts what we write. So that's the production of speech, whether it be written or auditory. It is fascinating. And sometimes, I don't know if you notice this, where you'll be thinking out loud, you'll be thinking so much, and all of a sudden you'll realize that you're actually saying it out loud. Like sometimes that speech just comes out and you don't even realize.
Yeah.
Like, I think I was just talking out loud.
Oh,
and then you look around, you're in the mall, and you think, did anyone else notice that? Maybe they just think I'm on my phone. Let me play it that way.
Because it is spontaneous. It just kind of just happens. You don't really plan it. I mean, some people do. Some people will stand there in front of a mirror or something, and they will have a deliberate conversation with themselves and just kind of say, well, they've got something coming up, maybe a meeting with someone, and they want to work out a strategy, maybe, or something like that, of how they're going to approach it. And so directly talking to themselves in the mirror, is this the same thing, or is that different because it's a deliberate thing that you're doing? It's not a spontaneous kind of inner speech that kind of comes out of nowhere.
Sure, that's an excellent question. And it brings us to this making distinctions between what type of thoughts we're having. So as you mentioned with the mirror, is that a kind of rehearsal? And that's great stuff. Like if you have a big presentation coming up and you're rehearsing in front of a mirror and you're trying to get comfortable with seeing yourself, give the presentation, presenting things, that's great. At the same time, there's also a kind of rehearsal that is sometimes associated with social anxiety disorder, which is before you go into a social event where it isn't a presentation, where it isn't something where you're going to be called on from a work perspective, where it's you are rehearsing your personality. That is different, and that has different implications in the sense that when you're looking at people who struggle with the physiological things that happen in social situations, for example, maybe they feel like their palms are getting sweaty, maybe they feel their heart racing or their face flushing when they're talking to someone. If they rehearse all of that in the mirror beforehand, it still isn't necessarily helping them with sort of attacking that social component. And what I mean by that is it's the exposure to having those physiological reactions and realizing that people don't notice that as much as you think they do. That it's not about rehearsing. It's about being in the moment and being spontaneous and not in your head worrying, oh my gosh, I'm starting to sweat. Oh my goodness, my hands are sweaty. Oh, I stumbled over my words. They noticed that I stumbled over my words. Oh my goodness. But if you rehearse that, that's not necessarily helping you in those spontaneous social situations. So there's rehearsal for things like presentations, which are helpful, but then we make that distinction in the treatment of social anxiety disorder that, you know, where ultimately you're asking people to go in a social situation and say something silly and seeing what happens and seeing that, you know, it's not as bad as you think it is.
Well, this is exactly what we want to talk about as well during the show today. How do you combat those negative thoughts? How do you get over them? How do you change them into something that is more positive? And one of the ways is cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. And this is very much your game, Chastity. So we'll be getting into that with you as the show progresses. Talking about the different ways that we talk to ourselves. Now, are you somebody who does that? Do you talk to yourself? Maybe you do it spontaneously. Maybe it's in the mirror, something very deliberate. And maybe you're someone who ruminates over thoughts and they kind of keep going and playing over and over in your head in a way that just makes it all very negative, bringing us down. And it could lead to panic attacks. It could lead to depression. Is it you? Is that somebody that you are talking to yourself? Maybe you do it, maybe you don't, maybe it's your partner. Because that's something that we need to say, that not everyone does this, Chastity. Not everybody does talk to themselves, or do they?
It's a difficult distinction to make. And what I would say is that we all have thoughts. And whether those thoughts are the kind of spontaneous, you know, oh, that's an interesting song, that's an interesting book, or things that come in from our environment. And the things that are that inner voice or that inner critic, everybody thinks. Mm. Everybody has thoughts at any given time. It's really hard. Our brain is working so hard to take in information from the environment and filter what is relevant to us and what isn't. You know, you're walking in the mall and you see someone that maybe has a pleasant disposition. You know, they might smile at you. You might smile back at them. You walking through the mall, you see someone that maybe has more angry or agitated face. You're taking in that information, or you see someone at the perfume counter that's walking over and wants to spritz you, and you're not even aware that you're taking that information in, but you're already noticing. So our thoughts are this complex interaction between what's going on in our environment. So it's hard to turn those off. And there are ways that we can be more present in the moment, and things like mindfulness, meditation, and those are also helpful in sort of helping us not become powerless to our thoughts. Because as you mentioned, Sally, rightly so, that the quality and character of the thoughts we have can affect our mood. It can affect the kind of memories that are called to mind. It can, you know, over time as a pattern, it's symptomatic of things like depression and anxiety. So part of the reason why things like self-talk is so important, because it does have these direct connections with psychological well-being.
So let's go through the different types now.
Okay.
Positive self-talk, affirmations, is that the same thing?
Well, what's interesting about positive self-talk, and it's different to affirmations, positive self-talk, I feel like I need to give a little bit of definition to that. And part of that is when you hear positive self-talk, and especially when I've worked with clients and I mention positive self-talk, I see many of them bristle, like, ugh.
And roll your eyes.
Oh, yes. They roll their eyes and it's like, it's okay. You're having a negative self-talk moment with me right now. And that's fine. But positive self-talk isn't cheerleading. It's not candy coating. I think that's what people sometimes misinterpret positive self-talk as this way of taking whatever is true and distorting it to suit you.
Because you kind of hear that sometimes, you know, you're in a situation where you might be feeling down, you might be feeling depressed, and then mm-hmm. somebody says, oh, be positive, you know.
Ah.
And it's just kind of like, well, no, actually, yeah. That's not going to work.
Yeah.
And it just feels like you're sugarcoating a situation which feels awful.
Yeah, absolutely. It's horribly invalidating, particularly if what you might need at that time is just some compassion and a sympathetic ear. And so that's another way that this positive self-talk can play out in a way that it's not intended. So it's not cheerleading. It's not, you know, for example, let's say someone lost their job. It's not about, oh, well, think about all the great things that are going on in your life. So it's not dismissing. That is an example of dismissing the reality of the situation. But then there's also the internal misconception of positive self-talk as a way of saying, oh, it's okay that I lost my job and I don't have any money in the savings. You know, I'm still going to go out with my friends. And it's a kind of denial. And that's not what positive self-talk is. Positive self-talk is aimed at giving you the support that you need to manage or act on or cope with a difficult situation. So it looks more like, yes, this is kind of a difficult situation that you're facing right now, but you've been through something difficult before and you've made it through, and you know let's look at what we can do to remedy the situation. Like, you have some skills, you have things that you can contribute to the situation, you're a loving, kind person, and those are the kinds of things that not only recognize the skills and capabilities that you have, but change the sort of orientation of your mind and will, in effect, cause you to act differently. And what I mean by that is that if you believe and you're talking to yourself in a kind and supportive way, you're much more likely to do things that are supportive and helping you achieve goals or that are in alignment with your values, as opposed to negative self-talk, which is where you're just dumping on yourself. Like, you know what? You lost your job. You weren't really good at it in the first place. You know, stuff like this always happens to you. When are you going to realize? That's the kind of thing that I think people think is going to motivate them, but ultimately has the opposite effect.
Because what you really want, what you're actually saying in this situation is, it's about finding your resilience. It's about mm-hmm. finding your strengths to mm-hmm. help you get through that situation which is not happy, is mm-hmm. not positive, but you've got to find those skills to get you through it.
Absolutely.
Which you have, and the attributes that you already have.
Absolutely. And that's it. And more often than not, our thoughts tend to be negative in orientation. And that makes sense from a evolutionary perspective. And what I mean by that is that we're sensitive to threats in our environment. We want to know when something's going to go wrong so we can anticipate it. We want to know how something's going to go wrong so we can do something about it. So we are, like it or not, you know, more geared toward noticing the things that go wrong. And that's protective. At the same time, with this in mind, so at the same time, it's really important to notice the things that go right. And that takes a little bit more activeness and awareness of cluing into those things that do go right, the things that we are good at. Again, not to dismiss all the negative, but just to round out a more complete picture of how we are.
It's interesting that you say it's natural for us to notice the negatives. Do women do it more than men?
I don't know how to answer that right now. Do women do it more than men?
I imagine that they would, only because we kind of tend to, and I'm looking at you, Joe, we know as women, we have this thing, particularly if you're a mum as well, it's like the risk management, right, of things that could possibly go wrong, and you're protective. It's that, what you're talking about, that protective instinct as well. So I'm imagining that women would do it more often, don't you think?
Oh, there's a sweeping generalization coming forward, but we like talking, don't we?
Yes, we do.
I think it's potentially managing lists and juggling, and we're verbalizing and emotional. But yeah, no, I don't. I see my husband talking to himself a lot. There's a lot of muttering. Tom Urquhart certainly talks to himself quite a bit.
He did admit to it. Yes, he did admit to it just now.
And it may be more rather than who notices the negativity more, or who notices what's negative more, men or women, more about who expresses it. And, you know, and again, sweeping generalizations.
Sure, but it's not the same in every situation, yeah. but maybe
women might be more inclined to talk about it than men do. And because of that, that might you translate into appearing to be more negative.
Is this where the whole nagging wife idea comes from?
Oh, you are hell. Wow.
I'm asking. These are things that I hear. These are things that, you know.
It could be. What's interesting about all of this, do you like how I'm trying to skirt the issue? Yes, I am.
You don't have to be, you know, so diplomatic about it. Just tell it how it is, Chastity.
I will tell you how it is. So what I think we see is symptomatic of what has worked in the past. And what's interesting is, you know, we're talking about behavioral principles, and nagging is an aversive stimulus to use some cycle. I know, eye roll, I'll explain what that is. And so you it's worked. To put it quite simply, we nag because it's worked. And it is so annoying to hear nagging that you end up doing it, but you're not doing it out of love. You're doing it because you just want someone to leave you alone. And it's in some ways, if we're linking this back to self-talk, part of the reason why we may have had these negative thoughts like, oh, you never get anything right. Why are you messing this up? Why can't you just be quiet? Why can't you just work a little bit harder? Why can't you be a bit more polished? All of these things, because perhaps in the past, we've heard that and has said, right, we're going to do something about this. I'm going to get up. I'm going to get out of bed. I'm going to man up. I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps. And you can hear what I'm talking about are things that I've heard from clients in therapy. There's a lot of cultural influence. And what I mean by this is, you know, people, this is how we've been raised in a lot of ways. You know, you don't say, oh, you can do it, honey. Chin up, little camper. We don't say those kinds of things because we haven't heard them. And they've worked in the past. And so this is what going back to negative self-talk, we do it because it has worked in the past. But over time, it is unhelpful and can become extremely maladaptive. And so this is where the positive self-talk isn't about ignoring the negative stuff. It really is about rounding out our way of understanding ourselves, our way of approaching things in life. So we can, I mean, simply put, when you think in a certain way, when you think positively, how does that affect your behavior? When you are kind to yourself, are you more likely to do more things?
Yeah, we're going to get to that in just a minute. How does it affect our behavior? How can we change those thoughts so that our behavior then in turn becomes something positive? We're with Chastity O'Connell, mental health counselor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. We're talking to Chastity O'Connell, mental health counselor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, and we're talking about self-talk. Do you talk to yourself, whether it's internally or out loud? And have you ever wondered what it means, why it happens, why do you do it? What's the effect that it actually has on you? Something that we were talking about just before we went to the break was negative talk, and how that can lead to things like, say, nagging, for instance. And we got a text from one listener saying, my husband says that I nag him and I'm just trying to ask him to do something in the house and he just doesn't listen. It really upsets me when he says don't nag. I think we need to talk a bit more about nagging.
Yeah, nagging is one of those words that comes up again and again in therapy, and it comes up between couples, but more interestingly enough, it seems like it comes up a lot between parents and teenagers, and you know, when they're parenting their children. So nagging is an interesting one because it is symptomatic of so many other things that are going on in the relationship. And ultimately, what you have going on is this lack of trust, in the sense that what I say, for example, if I'm asking my, you know, 16-year-old to pick up their cereal bowl and their socks, and they're sat in front of the TV, and it's like, please pick up your socks and your cereal bowl, please pick up your socks, and I'll do it, I'm in the middle of something. And so it becomes this, you know, it escalates when really, you know, we're not talking about you know, we're talking about just something simple. So part of that is trying to understand sort of the quality of the relationship and arming the individuals with tools on how to communicate more productively and more effectively, I should say, with one another. And so it might look like, you know, when you're eating, you know, how can we make this work? Mm. And so nagging is ultimately looking at how can what I say to you affect you? How can what I say have meaning for you? Where you can ultimately see and understand where that's coming from. It's not coming from a place of control. And I think this is what nagging ends up looking like. It's like, I'm trying to control you. I want you to do it now. When really it might look more like, I work really hard. I'm exhausted. I'm coming home. I work really hard to have a nice home. And when I see your socks lying there and your cereal bowl lying there, I feel like you're not respecting me. And so there's a lot of personal things that get played out when it comes to nagging. So it's looking at ways to say what you need to say and what you're hoping the other person will respond to, but also allowing them the venue to say, okay, can I do it at a commercial break? Or I will do it in just a few minutes. And it really is about opening this communication. So it doesn't have to be about, I'm just going to keep bringing it up till finally you cave in to spite me or in spite of what I'm doing, not really because you see any kind of utility or respect in what I'm saying, if that makes sense. That was a really long-winded explanation. But nagging is something that is symptomatic of other things going on. So from a therapeutic perspective, what we look at is the communication, arming people with tools to not only speak to one another, but how to receive what other people are saying to them. And ultimately, and to communicate what's underneath that nagging. The nagging isn't about the cereal bowl and the socks. The nagging is about, I am proud of this and I want to care for it. And I want you to respect me and to respect the way I care for it and in a certain way.
You want that person to jump up and do it immediately.
Yes, you do.
Out of love. Yes. And out of respect. If only.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But ultimately, what happens if you see how that conversation plays out? It's, why don't you ever pick up your cereal bowl and socks? Why are you so lazy? You know, or why don't you ever listen to me? I feel like I'm talking to a brick wall when I'm talking to you. And so it takes on a really, really painful painful tone, because part of that is we're trying to use a little bit of guilt and hope that, in the hopes that it might motivate someone else's behavior. When we talk from in a way that is showing how we're affected by it, like, I feel discouraged when I've worked all day and I see that this is how the home I'm trying to create for you, a safe, comfortable, happy home, is being treated. That's very different. People respond to that very differently than, why are you so lazy?
Well, the culprit has just texted in saying, devil's advocate, but the socks can sit harmlessly and be moved after the TV show.
Absolutely. And part of the role in working with people, working with folks in therapy, is helping softly start that conversation. So when, you know, interestingly enough, Gottman talks about the soft startup. And although he's a marriage therapist, he also, a lot of these principles can be used between parents and teenagers. And so if you start with a harsh startup, if you start with, why do I come home and find this like this? 94-92% of the time, the conversation is not going to end well. If you start off with something a bit more gently, like, you know, when there's a commercial break or at the end of the show, can you make sure you clean up your socks and your cereal bowl? Very, very different way of approaching that. So part of it is giving the person who is the accused nagger some tools to handle the situation differently, but also allowing them to receive, to be influenced by the person that they're talking to. Like, sure, mom, I'll do it, but I'm in the middle of this game right now. Can I do it in a half an hour? Giving them tools to recognize and validate the person's request, but also come back and say, okay, I will do it, but can I do it at a different time? Does it have to be right now?
It's all about the way you communicate, and that is what Chastity O'Connell, mental health counselor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, is all about today, all about the communication. It's just the way you say it. Coming back to self-talk, and we talked about positive self-talk earlier. Now, negative self-talk. You say, Chastity, that it's probably worked in the past and it tends to be in line with your cultural beliefs. It works sometimes?
It has worked sometimes. And we see this in therapy in the sense that people have used negative self-talk to motivate. And so they end up saying, like, why are you being so lazy? You just need to get up and do something about it. And so there's harsh things like lazy, and those words tend to stick. And so sometimes, you know, when we're in those moments of, you know, feeling like almost like bullying ourselves, we're like, okay, let's rise up and do something about it. And so sometimes it has worked in the past, but over time, and this is what I mean by maladaptive, over time, it's not helpful in the long run, because the quality of how we talk to ourselves takes on this negative tone. In the same way, it's almost like the nagging example. You know, when you ask someone, well, you're so lazy, why can't you clean up after yourself? I'm so sick of doing it. If you say to someone, you know, I really work hard to keep this house nice, can you help me out with this? Very different response from that person depending on how you address it. We are no different in the ways that we talk to ourselves. If we are talking to ourselves in a way that recognizes what we're good at and what we're not so good at, we will respond differently than always just nagging at ourselves with this negative self-talk. And even with negative self-talk, it has different dimensions to it. It's fascinating from a research perspective because, you know, as for the reasons that we talked about at the beginning of the show, is it, you know, the almost obsessional loop of replaying that embarrassing situation over and over and over again? Is it that we're driving along feeling pretty good and all of a sudden we're like in a bad mood out of nowhere? Or is it that we're trying to analyze or think about a situation over and over again. Those are all, from a psychological research perspective, different ways of talking to ourselves.
We're going to explore those different ways of talking in negative ways to ourselves and how to turn those around. We're speaking to Chasity O'Connell, mental health counselor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. We are taking your calls now. We've got Marina on the line. Hi, Marina.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
So my question is this. I've been doing a little bit of reading and thinking about this concept of the phases of relationships and the conflict stage and or the power struggle stage that couples can remain in for sometimes years until they've worked out how to speak to each other and how to accept each other's mannerisms or strengths and weaknesses. And so it came to mind when I was listening to you about the way that we talk to each other, because I feel like I'm stuck in this conflict stage and power struggle stage in my marriage, in large part in my delivery, not so much what I'm asking for, it's the way that I ask for it.
Yeah. Chasity, what's your advice?
So in thinking about relationships, and I love what you said is, and ultimately, you know, you're calling in reflecting on this and trying to find, I guess, more healthy or adaptive ways of trying to address conflict in the relationship. And there's some really great resources out there, and a lot of the ones that I use are from Dr. John Gottman. And so one of the things you mentioned is the tone and finding ways to approach the conflict in a way that's going to ultimately lead to a place where the relationship hasn't been harmed. And what Gottman would say about this is that there are complaints and there are criticisms in relationship. Complaints are perfectly valid. So I think this is, you know, what you're raising, I think, is going to be really helpful for a number of listeners out there. It is okay to complain. It's okay to not like things in your relationship. And that's a complaint. It's, I don't like this. Whereas criticism is attacking someone else's character. It's the way of saying, sort of the example I mentioned earlier, like, you are so lazy. It's not that the person is lazy, it's that you don't like dirty socks and a sink full of dishes. And so when we're looking at what is a complaint and what is a criticism and making that distinction and sort of changing what we're trying to communicate into a way that is more constructive.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you're exactly on it, because the feedback I get are that when I think I'm expressing a complaint, he's taking it as criticism.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so it must be in my delivery. And, you know, we can never run around with a tape recorder and you know, have this argument. But I feel like, you know, we go round and round with the same issues year over year over year. Mm-hmm. And this is what's so disheartening.
Mm-hmm. And what's, again, you're bringing up so many things, great things that I think are helpful, because so many people struggle with these. And so you mentioned the delivery. And earlier I had mentioned the harsh startup versus the softened startup. And again, that's the awareness of what I actually want is this. And by starting in a way that's gentle is going to get me there. But at the same time, you know, when we're trying to change our relational patterns, we still can sort of short circuit to those old types of patterns. And so you mentioned that your spouse takes it as criticism. And this is where we look at ways to help people soothe with the actual receiving the information. And so what I mean by that is, if, you know, you come home and you're, you know, one of your complaints might be, you know, why does the bedroom have to be such a mess? And instantly they might take that as criticism. And part of that might have to be with the amount of stress that they're under, the lack of sleep, exercise, nutrition, there's all these other things that are going on. And so part of what is taking that awareness and saying, you know what, I'm not in a great place to receive this right now, and I feel like I'm taking it personally. And so looking at ways to help that person soothe and help them learn to cope with receiving this kind of communication. And then there is one thing that I think is also interesting and really helpful for couples to know, which is that there are certain conflict. There's two types of conflict and probably a few more in between, but the two main ones are perpetual and solvable conflict. There are just certain types of conflict that you're going to argue about over and over and over again. And it's about how do you repair that conflict. And then there are some that are solvable. And it's understanding which and looking at the difference between the two. If you know that this is one of your hot buttons, you know this is one of those difficult areas, that, you know, you are a neat person and he's kind of much more relaxed about, you know, how things look. Oh, it's not messy. There's only 5 pairs of pants on the floor rather than my usual 8. Then that might be something, and just knowing that, I think, can be helpful for some couples, and that, you know what, this is just how it is, and we're going to have to find a different way of addressing this issue. So there's a lot of issues, and I don't mean to, you know, talk your ear off, but a lot of things that you brought up just in one simple conflict. And I think this is what's important for listeners to know, and for you to know as well, that it's complex. So,
you know, you gave me 3 really great places to start. For one, you know, there's 2 sides to everything, the receiving side and the delivery side. So there's lots of work that can happen there on both sides, receiving and delivery on both sides. And then also this idea of sitting down together and mapping out this idea that half of our issues are solvable and half of them are perpetual, like you said. And we could probably, you know, come up with a little code word and be like, perpetual, here we are.
Sure.
and have a laugh about it.
Absolutely.
Instead of constantly, having these blow ups.
Absolutely. And that, I think, is, you know, one of the key sort of, if we look at what healthy marriages are made of, they're made of couples that, not that they have no conflict, all healthy, happy marriages have conflict. They all have perpetual conflict. They all have solvable conflict. But they're able to repair. And I loved what you said about, perpetual. And you can have a laugh about it. And, you know, you can come up with your own way of what is it you need to manage this conflict in a way that will help you not take it personally? And what do I need to manage this issue in a way that's going to help me feel validated and listened to, and that it's important to you?
It's almost that thing of, we've got to just agree to disagree and laugh about it.
Yes.
Marina, I hope that's helped you out there. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you. Take care.
Brilliant. Thanks so much. We're getting to those self-talk issues of negative self-talk, that there are lots of different types. Some are good, some are not so good. How to not dwell on it. Looking at cognitive behavioral therapy, that is something else we're going to be looking at with you, Chasity, in just a moment. How to turn those negative thoughts around into something more positive. Plus, imaginary friends. We're going to get to that in the second hour as well. Should you have imaginary friends? I know a lot of kids have them, but should you keep them in adulthood? Lots more coming up on the Couch with me, Sally Musa, on Dubai Eye 103.8. Welcome back to the second hour with us here on the Couch. We're asking, do you talk to yourself and do you do it out loud? Have you ever wondered what it all means and why it happens? Do you find that it can be motivating to you, or is it something that drags you down, is really negative, causing you anxiety and panic and even depression, where you've got a bad experience, it just plays on and on, over and over in your mind? Here to discuss that and more, Chasity O'Connell is here, mental health counselor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. We're about to get into as well, Chasity, cognitive behavioral therapy. What is it? How does it it work and how can it help us change those negative thoughts that we might have? And plus, imaginary friends. What happens when we keep them beyond childhood? We're going to reveal which famous writer still relies on imaginary friends in his adulthood this hour. We started talking about imaginary friends as a great text. No name on it. Imaginary friends are fine as long as they don't move furniture or turn my child's neck 180 degrees. It sounds like this person has had some negative experiences with the imaginary friends.
Yes, or watching too many movies, or but watching, that's okay.
Yeah, watching too many movies. But coming back to self-talk, we actually covered positive self-talk, started talking a little bit about negative self-talk, and there are different types now. So rumination, a word that I wasn't familiar with before this, preservating. As well.
Perseverating.
Perseverating.
Yeah.
I'm going to get it right.
But persevering, not to be confused with persevering.
Okay.
It's hard.
Perseverating.
Perfect.
Okay, good. We got it. Okay. Rumination, perseverating. What's the difference?
Oh, yes. So when we're looking at, I think what's helpful about some of the different ways we talk to ourselves, and really these are different ways we think, it's important to know that part of sort of addressing this or looking at these isn't so much to necessarily make the distinctions about which ones I'm doing, but to just bring awareness to these different styles, and hopefully people will hear something that resonates with them, that, oh, I tend to ruminate, or, oh, I tend to perseverate, or, oh, yes, I do have those sort of intrusive thoughts that, you know, come in out of nowhere. And understand that these are all natural, and for a short amount of time, that, you know, they serve a purpose. It's when you find yourself ruminating for a long time where it can become unhelpful. And so with that, let me just define them a little bit.
Yes, please.
So,
yes.
And maybe even try and give some examples. So with ruminating is probably my favorite. And that's because it gives us this illusion of doing something that we think is helpful. So rumination is, the definition is this tendency to passively think about the meanings, origins, and consequences of our negative emotions. And so what this might look like is, for example, oh my goodness, my friend didn't text me back when they said they were going to, or they bailed on the plans that we were supposed to have. Why do they do that? Or I can't believe that they do that. You know, is this something, perhaps, you know, are they mad at me? I wonder if they're mad at me, but because I said that I would be there before, and I've been there for her for the past four times. And now, you know, when I need her, she's not around. So is she really a friend I can count on? Or you can see.
Isn't this just basically overthinking?
It's overthinking. It's
negatively,
and part of it, I don't want to sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater. Rumination in a short amount can be helpful. It is important to think about the deeper meanings of things. It's when we get stuck in it. It's when we are dwelling on it. It becomes brooding. And the difference between rumination and something like problem solving is that when you are ruminating, at the end of it, you feel worse. When you are problem solving and thinking about things like, how can I make this better? Maybe I can send her a text. Maybe I can say, oh, I really miss your friendship. And at the end of it, if you feel better, then it's problem solving. But the problem is when you're ruminating, is that you tend to think that you're working on it. Mm. Because we love to think, we love to analyze, we love to, you know, try and understand what's going on. And again, this gets back to that, if the more we understand, the more we can anticipate things going wrong. So rumination is one of my favorites, and part of that is because it does come so easily, and it is something we can do with other people. So there's co-rumination, where both of you are going down in the dark valley together.
Where both of you are just going down.
Yes.
We don't want to go through that. But we've got a caller on the line, Joaquin. Oh, we've lost Joaquin. We'll try and get him back on the line. But that can be even worse, can't it, Chastity, in terms of when you... When when you do it with someone else and you're yes. ruminating, it can compound the feelings of just the anxiety and just feeling just generally down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So by the end of it, not only...
But at the same time, you're kind of like also thinking, I need to let it out to someone. So mm-hmm. what, you know, how do you make it a positive experience where you're talking through that experience with someone, but it's not co-rumination?
Sure. And that's a great distinction. And I think it's a difficult one to make. It's a difficult one to make because we do need those moments of reflection where we are trying to gain insight, where we're trying to understand what the problem is. And reflection is a type of rumination. Mm. And reflection is not negative, but it is when we are when we're sort of stuck replaying or rehashing and just going over the elements of the situation where we're not introducing new information into it. We're just replaying the old stuff and not drawing in, well, yeah, that was really annoying, but you know what? She is going through a rough time. Or, yeah, that, you know, I was really disappointed, but mm-hmm. and you know, it's a difficult time for me, you know, where you're connecting it to deeper things that are going on. And so that's where rumination happens to all of us. We all do it at different points. It's the amount, and it's when we're stuck in it. And yes, like you said, venting, talking with someone about it, that can be extremely helpful, particularly in getting us out of our head. And so rumination is the stuff that's going on in our heads.
And then perseverating.
Perseverating is something that tends to be associated with ADHD, so attention deficit hyperactive disorder. But you hear it also used when people are just stuck and fixated on a thought, a topic, and they just can't seem to get rid of it.
It's just replay.
Yes.
In your head.
Yes.
That, you know, that negative experience that you had or whatever it is, just going on over and over mm-hmm. again. How do you escape?
Yeah. And so perseverating feels stuck, whereas rumination, it's tricky. It almost feels good in the sense that we think we're working on it, where... You know how you're with your friends and you're with a good friend of yours and you're talking about something, you know, might even be a little gossipy. And sometimes that takes on that feel good characterization, whereas perseverating, there again, isn't positive, and it keeps you in this place of self-doubt. You question everything. You're just stuck. You're fixated on something. And again, when we're looking at rumination or perseveration, it's not so important from a personal perspective to define which one am I doing. It's more important to understand that, oh my goodness, these are things. Sometimes they're helpful, most of the time they're not. If I do it too long, it's not. And oh, I didn't even realize that I do that, and I'm aware of it now, and maybe I can do something about it. So that's what's really important in understanding some of these different ways, these different thinking styles. Mm-hmm. And I don't even want to call them styles, patterns or ways that our mind works.
Because some of us also tend to worry.
Mm-hmm.
We have thoughts of worry and they just creep up and they take over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Worry is that repetitive, it's uncontrollable, and we're thinking about things that could go wrong, perhaps things that have gone wrong in the past, and how do we avoid it going wrong in the future? And so worry does take on this, you know, rumination character. So yeah, absolutely. Worry falls right into that basket as well.
Intrusive thoughts now.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you're kind of, it's just really random.
Yes.
And you get a strange thought and you don't even understand or know where it came from, but it's often something that's inappropriate and it's something that is really negative and you just think, why am I thinking this?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do with that?
Wow, that one, so intrusive thoughts are sometimes associated with, I'll get to that in just a minute, but intrusive thoughts, they happen to us all. So it's really natural where some of my favorites are, if you're sitting in your child's school musical or performance and you just want to stand up in the middle of it and shout something inappropriate, or if you're standing on the edge of some high building and you think, what would it be like? And these can take many different forms, and it's not like you act on them, but there's just this little blip in your mind that you think, why did I think that? What is wrong with me? So they're natural. We don't act on them. At the same time, from a clinical or psychological perspective, things like intrusive thoughts can be associated, or intrusive memories, with things like post-traumatic stress disorder. And can also have an obsessional quality and associated with obsessional OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, where you can't stop the thought that something bad is going to happen, or you can't stop the thought that, did I leave the coffee machine on? Did I leave the stove on? Did I leave the stove on? And then you have to check on it. So what's interesting about these is that when we start acting on them is when they can take on a negative, when they can have a negative hold in our life.
Mm. Coming up next, we're going to keep talking to Chasity O'Connell, mental health counselor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, about how to turn those negative thoughts around using techniques like cognitive behavioral therapy. We are talking self-talk with Chasity O'Connell, mental health counselor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. And 04-423-1010 is the number if you want to get in touch to speak to Chasity. On the line, Chasity, we've got Ali. Ali, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Tell us about what you think about what Chasity's been saying about rumination.
So I have this, well, I don't know if you would call it an issue, because Chasity says that there's a positive to having those ruminating thoughts as well, but I have this tendency to overthink things. So just to give you an example, let's say I have a couple of friends, and one friend tells the other something, maybe a secret or some sort of life-changing event or whatever, and doesn't tell me, it, you know, sends me down this spiral of, like, overthinking. Oh, am I not close enough to that person, or did I do something to offend them, you know? And I guess it starts out as overthinking, and eventually it just, like, spirals into, like, perseverating, because then I'm just, like, you know, I don't know how to stop it. And for me, like, the way I tackle it is I stop thinking about it completely. So I guess you'd say I avoid it. I compartmentalize it in, like, the small corner of my brain, just don't think about it anymore. But my mom has the same issue, and she's not able to control herself. So with her, she just keeps thinking about it over and over again, and, like, the thoughts turn darker and darker and darker.
So, and it just snowballs for her.
Yeah, it just snowballs for her. For me, I just avoid thinking about it completely, and, like, just act as if it's not really an issue. And I don't think that's healthy either, because it's not like I'm not really addressing the situation. So I don't know how else to handle it.
Mm-hmm. Chasity.
There's a lot of great things there that to sort of talk about. One of the things you mentioned at the beginning was that rumination being positive, and I want to just say that it's natural, but it's not it's not positive, if that makes sense. So it's something we all do, and it's a part of a process. And so just keep that in mind. It's when it becomes, when it's prolonged, where it becomes unhelpful for us. And you mentioned the example with your mom, where the thoughts get darker and darker, and we would look at, you know, those thoughts and also how she reacts to them, and how and what her behavior looks like. Does she start withdrawing socially? And maybe these are some of the questions to think about with you as well. And so, you know, when you compartmentalize and when you start switching off these thoughts and not thinking about them, how does that affect how you interact with people? How does that affect your work? Does it?
So, like, for my mom, she's a social person, and so am I. But for her, she withdraws
Just to give you an example, we've got this huge wedding thing going on right in my family. And my extended family has done like a lot of horrible stuff to my mom. Just like family stuff. It's really common in Asia. And the thing is that she tries to get over it, but like, you know, those thoughts are always there. So if there's even if something happens, right, that's just a coincidence or just like a, you know, like a misstep on someone else's part, it sends her down that spiral, and then she just sort of like shies away from talking to those people and from people in general. Me, on the other hand, I'm really social as well, but what I do is that I just become more exuberant. So I kind of like have this poker face, and I don't think about it, and I just act like, you know, it's, and then maybe later on, like when I'm back home or whatever, right, and I'm alone, I'll think about it. And partly the reason I think I do that is because I'm kind of like convince my mom that it's not an issue. And to do that, I have to act like it's not an issue. Chastity, if that makes sense.
Chastity, is this maybe something to do with personality types? A pessimistic personality type as opposed to, say, an optimistic personality type, maybe in Ali's case, that he wants to look at the positive and he wants to stop that kind of behavior? Or is it something else?
It's difficult to say with any amount of definity with just a little snapshot of the situation at this stage. What we would look at is the question, you know, how does this type of thinking affect how you behave? And in your mom's situation, you mentioned that she withdraws and that anything that happens in the future is sort of that shortcut to that negative place. And this is a perfect example of what I was saying earlier about how negative self-talk over time, because we are looking for, I shouldn't say we're looking for, but we are sensitive to perceived threats in our environment or perceived negative things in our environment. And so when we see something that is negative, we're going to take that as confirmation that, ah, yes, see, I should have been on guard. See, I should have known better. See, these people aren't like I imagine them. And we go back into that protective withdrawal mode. So, you know, how you're describing your mom is sort of an excellent example of how over time these negative thoughts can overtake our sort of disposition or our lens, where we're filtering anything positive and only adhering or noticing those negative things. In your situation, which is interesting, you mentioned that you get exuberant, you have the poker face. And so some of the questions that I would ask would be looking at if you feel that is there stress or is there distress or pain associated with how you're coping with it? To get an understanding of, you know, sometimes things are happening. You mentioned that this is a wedding. Weddings are enormously stressful. You also mentioned that there are some family dynamics that are going on. And so part of, you know, understanding is trying to get a picture of whether or not this is sort of symptomatic of a very stressful time in your family, or is this something, as Sally had mentioned earlier, is this part of like sort of how we cope personally, and this is part of our personal coping style, or is this something associated with an ongoing family dynamic that has, you know, contributed to what could be a negative lens? So I've given you a lot of things right here, so I'll distill it down just to try and ask you a more simplistic question, which is, you know, this poker face that you put on, is it something that you feel that you're putting on, or is it something that you're like, you know what, that bothered me, I was irritated by it, but, you know, I feel like I've dealt with it and I want to move forward? Or is it something like, you know, chin up, don't feel it, just keep going, just ignore it, that kind of thing?
So I think that it's probably the second one. And the thing is that my mom, right, because of the stuff that's happened in the past, she's had these blowouts where she's confronted these people in public, and it's been really messy and, you know, sort of created a scene. And I guess that people would expect me to do it, which is why I try even harder to not do that. So even if it's like something that's really pissing me off, I would just like completely like not in that moment like address it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's partly the reason. Like I try and tell myself, you know, whatever, it just happened. Like let's just get over it. But it's also that. But partly it's also because I just want to try and make sure I don't do the same thing my mom's done, because people expect me to do it.
Okay.
We're going to have to leave it there. But thank you so much, Ali, for your call. We really appreciate you sharing your story. But I like his style. He's just, you know, won't even entertain the thought, and just wants to move on as well. And it can be difficult for somebody else who doesn't quite know how to do that. We'll talk a bit more about Ali's situation and with his mum as well when we come back, and to talk about cognitive behavioural therapy. We are going to get to that next. It is Dubai Today with me, Sally Musa, on Dubai Eye 103.8. Lots of talk about self-talk today when we talk to ourselves. What does it mean? Is it negative? Is it positive? Is it helping us out, or is it bringing us down? Also, your questions are coming in on 400. And on the app. Chasity O'Connell is here, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, to answer those. And Chasity, we had Joaquim who tried to call in earlier, but his problem was basically this. He and his wife, they both suffer from anxiety because both their children are back in their home country, and they are wondering how to get over this anxiety, how best to deal with it. It can be very difficult when your parents and you're not in the same place as your children, for whatever reason that is. So let's talk through the different ways that they can deal with this, and cognitive behavioral therapy might be a technique that they could use.
Absolutely. Some of the questions I would ask just to get a fuller sense of the picture would be, they mentioned suffering from anxiety, and I'd want to know whether or not they were formally diagnosed, if this is something that they have themselves are saying what their situation is, or is it a mental health professional or a clinician has said that, yes, you are struggling with anxiety. That's important because, as we know, there's a lot of information out there, and sometimes it's helpful, sometimes it's not, and so that's something to keep in mind. I would also want to know a bit more about the anxiety that they're struggling with right now. Is it something that they've struggled their entire life and this is part of, or is this something situational, or is this anxiety directly in response to having their children in a different country? Because that's also important. If it's a situational issue where something's happened and they're now dealing with it, the approach, the way we would approach that might differ from someone who has struggled with anxiety their entire life. But in looking at techniques, you mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is fantastic.
What is it, first of all, for those of us who have no idea what you're talking about?
It is, to sum it up, it is a way of understanding how our thoughts influence our emotions, which influence our behaviors. And that's sort of the simple kind of CBT model. So I'll give you an example, because I think examples tend to be more illustrative than descriptions. So let's say you're driving along down Sheikh Zayed Road and a car swerves in front of you. And, you know, what is your reaction when that car swerves in front of you? It could take a myriad of reactions. So it could be something as something like, oh, these drivers are so frustrating here. It could be, oh, I'm going to be late. I can't believe the way that, you know, people drive. Or it could be something like, they look like they're in a big hurry. And depending on how you sort of respond to that situation, to that trigger, is going to influence your emotional sort of response. And that emotional response is going to influence your behavior. So let's say you're in the camp that's like, oh, that's so frustrating. People need to learn how to drive. You're going to be angry. And maybe you might try and speed up and cut them off or play a little bit of a cat and mouse game, which you get to work, you're irritated, you're stressed, it's still lingering. You might even talk to someone about it when you get to work, and all of a sudden it's tainting into your day. Whereas if you had someone say, oh, they look like they're in a hurry, your emotional response from that would be a kind of neutral, like, okay. And you might like lay on the brake a little bit to let them in. And before you know it, that sort of emotional response is passed, and you get to work and things are fine and you move on with your day. And so what's interesting about this is that the thoughts that we have in response to life circumstances, whether it be traffic, whether it be a colleague who sent us a snarky email, whether it be, you know, a husband or wife that's coming home late, we have responses, we have thoughts about these. And these thoughts happen so quickly that they're almost automatic. We don't notice them. In fact, we usually notice the mood that we're in, or we notice the emotion before we actually notice the thought itself. And when we're in that mood, we tend to act in alignment with that mood. If you're angry, you're going to drive more aggressively on the road. If you are feeling pretty happy, you are more likely to do something to support that mood. So mood supportive actions. And so CBT is a way of understanding the automatic thoughts that we have, the ones that happen so quickly that we don't really notice, and how it influences our emotions and behaviors, but ultimately how they can, these are symptomatic of a deeper sort of core belief, a deeper lens that we have on how we view the world. And what I mean by this is that depending on your frame of mind while you're driving down the road, that automatic thought happens, is that you might have a lens on how you see the world. And if you see the world as sort of people are out there to get you, people aren't trustworthy, you're going to interpret events in your life in alignment with that sort of core belief, as opposed to someone else who might think, you know what, the world's a pretty good place. That's annoying. That's helpful. I love that. I'm not crazy about that. That's going to interpret how you see events as well. And so from building awareness of how we respond to things, we respond to the environment, can help us find ways to intervene so we're not in that negative, sad, anxious, depressed state as a result of thoughts. Because if you ask people the moods that they're in right now, more often than not, it's not because something's happened, it's because they've had a thought about something happening. So if I asked you, the listeners out there, to think about something that irritated you in the past week, just by asking you to think about that, you might be feeling irritated, even though that thing happened a few days ago, but you'll still be potentially re-experiencing, you'll still be feeling that irritation just thinking about it. So oftentimes we're responding to our thoughts, not actual things that are happening in our environment.
Okay, so how do we change it?
Oh my goodness. The first step, and I think this is one of the most incredible, is building the awareness and working with clients in therapy. Just asking them, so tell me what you felt this past week. Well, I felt depressed or I felt anxious. Okay, tell me the situation, and then talk to me about what are some of the thoughts you had. And they're always pleasantly surprised when they realize that the way that they felt was in response to a thought. So just building awareness about how sometimes we're in these mood states and it's because of a thought. And secondly, you might look at ways to intervene. So you might look at asking people to look for evidence in the environment. So if you think that everybody's a terrible driver and you think nobody knows how to drive and everybody needs to learn how to drive out there, take your eyes off of the car that cut in front of you and have a look at all the other cars on the road. 95% of the time, they'll be driving in the lanes that they're supposed to in varying degrees of speed. So there isn't really evidence to suggest that everybody needs to learn how to drive. And so that's one thing, is looking for evidence. What's interesting though is that although I use a lot of CBT and I find it extremely helpful, I use also a lot of CBT's sister, which is acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, and where sometimes it's not about challenging the thoughts or coming up with positive alternatives. It's about sometimes just feeling that distressing feeling that pain that you're in right now, and allowing yourself to understand that that pain doesn't last forever. And so there's all sorts of tools in the CBT tool belt, but the primary ones tend to look at looking for evidence, positive self-talk, you know, again, what we were talking about in the beginning, not candy coating, not trying to ignore what's going on or the reality of a difficult situation, but expanding that perspective to look at the fact that there are some good things or that there are some strengths in this situation.
Is it something that you can do on your own? Do you need to do it with a professional? We're going to be discussing that with Chasity next, and also talking a little bit about imaginary friends. Why do we need them, apparently, in adulthood? You might just need them to be able to express your feelings. That's next. It's our last few moments with Chasity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. A really interesting discussion today about self-talk, talking to yourself. Are you saying things that are negative? Are you saying things that are positive? And how do we turn those negative thoughts, that negative self-talk, into something that will help rather than hinder? It's a really interesting topic because, as you say, as we did say in the beginning, Chasity, people who talk to themselves are, have been said to be geniuses. You know, it does help you. It helps you to learn. There are advantages to talking to yourself, but to make sure to do it in the right way. And just before the break, you started talking about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and how that can help you turn your thoughts from something negative to something more positive. Now, is it something that you have to do with a therapist, with a psychologist, or is it something you can practice on your own?
In a lot of ways, I would say it depends. I know that's not, it's sort of the standard psychological answer. The clinical answer is it depends. So it depends on the severity of what the person is experiencing, as well as the diagnosis. And so typically you tend to hear CBT being used for depression and anxiety. And there's some excellent workbooks out there for people that experience mild to moderate depression or anxiety that they can do. There are some excellent initiatives being done with sort of computer-based CBT, where you work with a program or you work with a therapist, and some of the homework is done via the computer. And those are excellent as well. They have a lot of research to back them up. And that is a nice option, particularly for teens who tend to be more comfortable with technology than maybe meeting face-to-face with a therapist. And for those that are experiencing more moderate to severe, then it's something it's best done with a mental health professional, be it a psychologist, a mental health counselor. And what's great is that although there's CBT, there's different approaches. CBT has a lot of research behind it. At the same time, we also know from the research that it's important to understand to acknowledge that it is the therapeutic alliance. It is the relationship between the psychologist and the client that is really important as well. So it's important to find someone you trust, someone that's competent, someone that's licensed, and someone that you connect with. Otherwise, even the best tools won't be as effective. So that's really important.
Well, that's cognitive behavioral therapy for those who are interested in it. But a topic that caught producer Joe's eye as well is imaginary friends. There is a very famous comedian and author who has just recently admitted that he has clung on to the friends that he invented as a child. And apparently this is something that can help adults make sense of their emotions. We are, in fact, talking about David Walliams, very famous British comedian and children's author as well. He actually said, when confronted about this, he said, "They're still my friends. they're not imaginary, are they? But it brings that question of, should you be holding on to imaginary friends, and why do people do that? And there are different ways that people do that. Just reading through one particular article of somebody who talks about their father and how their father finds it difficult, an older man finds it difficult to express his emotions. So if you asked him how he was feeling, he would just say fine. Mm. But if you really want to know how he was feeling, you would ask about his dog.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would probably answer with something like, oh, well, you know, the dog's depressed since I broke my hip.
Mm.
When actually, you know, he's actually speaking about himself and how he's really and truly feeling. But it's that interesting question of projecting your own real, true feelings onto somebody else, whether they're imaginary or real. In this case, it's a dog.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of detaching yourself so that you can express yourself better. How does that work, Chastity?
Sure. Well, if you think about asking someone how they're really doing and expecting an answer other than fine, it requires a comfort with being vulnerable. And for a lot of people, that's just, it's uncomfortable. And there's a variety of reasons for that. It could be, you know, culturally that you're not supposed to talk about your feelings. There's a gender component. Men aren't supposed to have feelings. There's also the, you know, do I trust this person? You know, are they going to talk about me behind my back? Are they going to hold on to this? Are they even going to be able to do anything about it? Is it going to be any good? Or is it going to do me any good to even put it out there? So just in a question of how are you doing? No, really, how are you really doing can be an incredibly sensitive one for a lot of people. And so, like you were saying, to allow them some space to talk safely is kind of an interesting one. With working with children in therapy, you can use dolls, you can use toys that can reenact some of the situations that they've been through. I've heard some really beautiful ways of, it's not necessarily imaginary friends, but people talking to loved ones that have passed away and still maintaining that relationship. And so we would look at just what they get from the relationship. Is it a source of safety, comfort, trust? And that's ultimately what matters.
It's such an interesting subject.
Yeah,
I think we're going to have to revisit it in another show in the new year. But Chastity O'Connell, mental health counselor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
It's been a great show, and we've learned a lot.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.